Welcome to the Been There, Got Out podcast. I'm Lisa, a state-certified domestic violence advocate and veteran of more than 8 years in the trenches of the legal system, the last five successfully representing myself.
And I'm Chris. I'm a certified high-conflict divorce coach. And between the two of us, we have all this knowledge and experience that we never wanted. But now we can put it to great use, providing expert guidance to people in high conflict divorce and custody situations, so you have the best chance in court and beyond.
Having the right support from people who get it is so critical to getting you and your children through it as unscathed as possible. And that's exactly what we do through our interviews with experts and other content right here on this podcast. So let's get to it. It's Lisa from Been There, Got Out. And tonight's guest is a little more unusual than what we usually have. Well, a little more unusual. His name is Dr. Jacob Schumann, and he is an embryologist and IVF specialist. And we popped on about 50 minutes ago just to do a little tech test because I wasn't sure if he knew how to get on, but there he is. And let me get him in here and get started. It's always impressive when my guest is like, boom, I'm here. I'm ready to go. So,
Good evening, Lisa.
Should I be calling you Dr. Schumann? What should I refer to you as?
You're actually not a doctor at all because I'm not a doctor.
Okay, Jacob. I thought you were a doctor because the fact that you're an embryologist sounds so fancy.
It's fancy. It sounds fancier than it is. But I have a master's degree from Eastern Virginia Medical School and a bunch of certifications that are required to manage laboratories. But having a PhD is common in my part of the IVF career path.
Okay. So let me just tell everybody how we met, and then you can introduce yourself and give a little more about your credentials. So, those of you that know us with Been There, Got Out, you know, we deal with these high conflict, divorces and separations and post-judgment issues. And so, we always say that our content is driven by our clients, and we happen to have a client who is pregnant but also has embryos. And so we're putting together a parenting plan for the future. And of course, our client wants to keep the embryos and wanted to know, how can I put the embryos in the parenting plan? I thought, I have no idea. And coincidentally, that same, like 2 days after this conversation happened, Jacob's name popped into my mailbox with my business networking group. And they said, guess what? We're going to bring an embryologist. So I leapt on him and said, oh, I need to talk to you. And it led to this interview, which we tried to do a few weeks ago. And actually, we both were sick. But I'm so glad that you were able to come on now. So why don't you quickly introduce yourself and let's get right to it.
Sure. Yes, Lisa, it was great meeting you. I'm a career-long embryologist. I started as a biology major at Hofstra on Long Island. And I had a friend's father was a doctor of IVF at the time, and I asked for an internship, and that was 20 years ago. I've scraped and crawled my way up the IVF ladder as a lab person for the last 20 years. It's at the bare bones, it's medical technology, just at the top of the food chain, as a lot of the different decisions and skills that we use in the lab are kind of subjective, meaning that how good of a job we do in the lab and how we carry out things and our protocols can make a large impact on the patient's outcome. If you look on the Society for Assisted Reproductive Technology, you'll see that there are some clinics within the under 35 group, which is typically the best litmus test of a program. In that group, you'll have clinics with pregnancy rates that are in the 30s, and you'll have some clinics that have a pregnancy rate in the 70s. And so there's just a few standards in the field, but we're always trying to make more to kind of, you know, keep things and more of us in the middle of the road. But what we do in the lab largely impacts outcomes. And so being a well-rounded technician means that you should be able to pick up on some knowledge from the field on the clinical side, and also the post-analytic, the ethical side, and, you know, knowing what happens to gametes and how storage affects, or how the possible outcomes can be affected by storage, can be affected by consents, you know, really makes a difference in providing our total package to the patient.
Yeah. And I was just saying before, when we popped on to do our little tech test, that I recently found out that one of the law firms that we're going to be doing some collaborations with had an IVF attorney on staff. And I didn't realize how common an issue it is with divorce attorneys and IVF issues. And so I know you're going to talk about that a bit, but why don't, like, so I mentioned in the beginning of this conversation about a client who wants to know what happens to these embryos after separation. I know you told me what she should look for, but why don't we, we talk with our bigger audience at the moment, and also who will see the recording, what happens to embryos after separation or divorce?
Well, first, it's going to depend on what state you're in. And so how a state have managed these types of cases in the past is typically the best place to look first. And so if there's a precedent, as many states already have, that's going to help kind of get an idea of where a lower court, who the lower court might side with in the case of a dispute issue. But the first and foremost thing you can do before you even get to the egg retrieval is to make sure that you read your consents. And so what any court is, if there's a dispute, any court is going to first ask, please show us the consents you signed. And in those consents, there should be an agreement on what to do with the embryos, on an embryo disposition in the event that the couple gets divorced, and God forbid one of the partners passes away, or in the event that the storage bill is just no longer paid and there's after due diligence that the company can no longer find the patient. And so that's going to, that primarily has been the deciding factor in these court cases you don't hear about, the ones that are easily resolved. And the more major dispute cases, they can't find those documents, or the clinic can't produce them. And then you get into some litigation matters. Typically there's two types of cases that you hear about when it comes to IVF. One is the one that we're talking about, Lisa, which is disputes between partners or surviving partners and the cryopreserved material. And it basically over means the control of the cryopreserved material. And then the other type of case is basically disputes between providers and patients. And you hear those more frequently, you know, as IVF has gotten more more popular, for lack of a better word, you know, and more prevalent in the community, that you've heard of these, you know, on the mainstream media. This can be, you know, going back to, these were some of the early cases, like in 1978, around the same time that the first IVF baby in America was born, Louise Brown, there was a case of clinic-to-clinic transportation in New York in a taxi, and none of the eggs survived, and that person was awarded $250,000 for the female, and then the husband, the partner in the situation, got $1 for the eggs, quite famously, just for record keeping. Yeah, but those are very, very, unfortunately, those pop up. You have, you know, the scenario more recently in the past few years where there was a negligence on tank storage in Ohio, and the Cleveland Clinic got sued for not properly taking monitoring the tanks. And so the patient sued the provider. There was a very famous case in Irvine, California, where it was the first ever case of misuse of eggs, where a physician, or I don't remember if it was physicians, were using some portion of donated eggs and fertilizing them with a partner specimen, but not fertilizing the egg of the autologous egg of the wife and implanting those embryos. And those resulted in, I believe, 15 pregnancies. And there was a gigantic lawsuit for the University of California at Irvine. So those are the more patient provider, you know, kind of disputes. But obviously you deal more, your clients are dealing more with the divorce side more commonly. And the most famous case for that happened in the 90s. And I don't, you know, if you remember back in Dateline times, Ted Koppel was talking about this case for about 3 years, and everybody had their ear to the stereo listening to this. So Davis versus Davis was the first case where you had patients. One partner wanted to keep the embryos. Her intent was to use them after divorce, but later decided that she was just going to anonymously donate them. And then the male partner said that he wasn't comfortable with that idea. And so it was in Tennessee, and it got up to the Tennessee Supreme Court. And this was the first time that a court had ruled that embryos did not constitute as property, and they also did not constitute as life. They used the coin pre-embryos. And basically they sided with the medical community and saying that for the first time, a court used the language of the potential for life, which is quite correct. You know, without a uterus, an embryo is just programming, you know, with the potential for life. You know, in the medical community's opinion, once it does implant and starts producing HCG, you know, as an implantation, then it is life with potential. And so the court ruled this way and made it special property and basically gave more value in this case to the husband's decision not to procreate than it did to the wife's desire to procreate. So the embryos were subsequently destroyed. And so most courts are going to try to avoid the characterization of embryos as persons or people. And they try to kind of dance around that subject and rule them as pre-embryos set forth by this Tennessee court as property. And so they're going to basically first ask that to see what consents you signed. And if no consents were signed, they're going to do their best to adhere to the constitutional rights of both partners and, the property rights of the pre-embryos. And that's the most common situation you'll find. So the best thing your clients can do to protect themselves is know what your consents say and know what you signed and have a record of them.
Wow. So that's like when they go to the clinic, it's a contract and that's what they need to save.
Exactly. Otherwise, you know, a court's going to have to deliberate whose decision has more value. More recently, about 2 years ago, there was a decision in Connecticut. It was, I believe, Goodwin versus Balbo. And the male in this scenario wanted to use the embryos, but the female did not. And in this scenario, the court ruled for the female and decided that these embryos, this court, they had the consent in this case. And so the court just basically said that per your consent that you signed at the clinic prior to these embryos being created, the embryos will be destroyed in the scenario of a dispute. And they carried that out. So it stands to reason that Connecticut is going to rule in favor of whatever you signed before you get to, you know, when you get to that scenario, if you do.
And in terms of the state deciding, I keep thinking in the back of my head about Roe v. Wade. And I know you said that doesn't really impact this, but did states tend to go, I mean, we have 50. So from what you've seen, do they tend to go with more destroying embryos if you can't find any record and there's a dispute?
That seems to be the way to go. You know, in California, Michigan, Tennessee set the precedent. But yes, and when it comes to a dispute, most states don't have any rules about the personhood of embryos. Most of them will just rule them as special property and try to assign value to whoever whoever has the most claim to the embryos. Most of the time, it seems to be in the females' hands to decide whether or not they want to further utilize them.
Okay, so say someone has their consent forms and they want to change it for they're doing a parenting plan. So the consent forms were done years ago and now they're making a parenting plan. And in the parenting plan, they put something different than what the consent form said originally, but then both parties signed the parenting plan, which is also signed as a legal document. Do you know if that would take precedent over what was signed at the clinic? Or do you think
I'm not 100% sure. I think if both parties were amenable to a change to the consent, then I don't see why a court wouldn't rule into the amenable decision. But obviously, if one is okay with the new decision and one does not want to sign, then that would lead to more litigation.
Yeah. Wow. All right. There was something else. So I assume the cases you just talked about are with that. You said there was a lawyer named Susan Cochran, maybe, who was
Susan
like
Crockin.
Crockin,
Susan
sorry.
Crockin is infamous. I believe she's a Harvard professor or maybe in New York, who is made her way through the IVF circles as a very frequent lecturer. You know, she's helped us keep informed of creating those consents that alleviate these types of disputes. She's been a great resource for IVF clinics. And so an easy Google search of her name will pull up many of the cases that she's litigated on for reference.
Okay, now you said she's infamous.
Right, only by name because of having been around these types of cases for so long.
Uh-huh. Okay. All right. So you also said that there should be a question asked before coming to an office like yours that couples should ask. Do you remember what that was?
There's a number of questions that they should ask themselves. I could think of a few off the top of my head. I would say to any couple wanting to go through IVF, just to make sure that they ask those hard questions, that any married couple should ask themselves before going down this path. And do I really want children? How much am I willing to do in order to have children? And if we're going to freeze embryos, what are the possible outcomes of those embryos if either one of us are not around? And what would we want to do with them in the future? Because there's three scenarios. In America, especially, IVF clinics are all about maximization when it comes to doing IVF. And so the more eggs yielded in a retrieval in an IVF cycle, the more chances you do have to, achieve a usable quality embryo. And so in those scenarios, most patients typically have something to freeze afterwards. And so you can have embryos frozen, as long as you're willing to pay the bill, because there is no shelf life to having embryos stored in liquid nitrogen. And so the possible outcomes for those embryos are to use them, to discard them, to donate them anonymously to another couple, or to donate them to research and training. And so it's a smart thing to do to discuss what of those options are comfortable for each other. If you've already decided to go through IVF, so that in these scenarios, and I guess, sorry, I forgot, a divorce as an option, separation. In those scenarios, are you going to be comfortable with what to do with those embryos if it comes up?
Yeah. Wow. I mean, I guess for people not involved in that, it's like we never consider something like that. But it's a huge investment also, right? I have no idea. But we always hear of how expensive it is. Just out of curiosity, what's the range of what people might end up spending on IVF?
I've seen anywhere from $8,000 to $9,000, meds included, to like $15,000 for an autologous sexually intimate partner couple. And then if you add donors, donor specimens in that scenario, you can be looking at a $20,000 to $25,000 cycle.
Wow.
Yeah.
Incredible. Yeah. All right. What are some common misconceptions about IVF?
That quantity is better than quality. Having a large cohort of embryos isn't necessarily better than just a small cohort of eggs and resulting embryos. There's no damage. No studies have shown any large impacts on health of embryos frozen. There's no transmission of diseases through liquid nitrogen storage of embryos. There's more common ones. Most couples don't end up going through IVF that show up for fertility related issues to the IVF clinic. Most couples just need a little bit of education. And that can include, putting together a calendar that recognizes the timing of the ovulation cycle and things of that nature. A little bit of smart targeted reading can go a long way. But the best thing to do do some grounded level research on Google. You know, just because you read something doesn't mean you have that diagnosis. And then not being afraid to go to the doctor and getting more information, because information is your friend. So the more you can, more resources you have to answer questions, the better you are. I try to have a service on the side, you know, as a consultant for patients, you know, who are struggling to come up with answers, that have been through IVF multiple times and want a lab's perspective. You know, so the lab sees gametes that in ways that the other, you know, parts of the clinic don't. And so sometimes people just need a push in the right direction with some outside information that you don't normally hear.
Wow. Okay. So you had said that most people are barely educated in their own fertility, and I'm one of them.
Did I say barely? Maybe I shouldn't be so cynical.
You did, and you said there's a couple of places that they can do to look to do this research. Do you have a couple of websites?
Reproductive Facts is a very good website. Fertility Lifeline is a very good website. And of course, the American Society for Reproductive Medicine has a very comprehensive website as well, where you can look at statistics and all kinds of things related to IVF, and for even more resources than the ones I remember.
Okay, great. All right. So how can people find you, Jacob, if they're interested? I mean, a lot of our people are in the midst of getting, you know, separated. So, but other people might look at this and be like, I want to get some perspective.
Sure. At this point, the best way to find me is through my Instagram, Schumann_says, and feel free to send me a private message and I'll respond.
Okay, great. All right. Thank you so much, Jacob. This is like really different and fascinating. And I have a feeling that certain people will get a lot out of it.
I'm glad to hear it. You're welcome, Lisa. Have a great holiday.
All right. You too. Bye.
Thanks. Bye.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Been There, Got Out podcast. Please leave us a review on whatever platform you're listening on. And you can find us easily on all major social media, but especially Instagram and YouTube. If you think we might be able to help you with your own situation, just visit beentheregotout.com and click the button to schedule a complimentary discovery call. Thanks again, and see you next time.